Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we're chatting with Peter Wesley. Peter is well known around the Australian security scene, but a few years back, he relocated to China, where security and the security industry is booming. He did a presentation at the AusCert Security Conference on the Gold Coast last week, all about the Chinese hacker scene and industry, and he joins us in this week's feature interview to tell us about how the Chinese scene evolved and what its current relationship with the Chinese government looks like. That's this week's feature. This week's sponsor interview is great. We'll be joined by Ryan Callimer, Senior Vice President of Strategy with Proofpoint, the email filtering company. And Ryan is along to talk about a phenomenon the Proofpointers are very interested in. We've all heard of VIPs, very important people, but he's here to talk about VAPs, very attacked people. So much attacker behavior these days is driven by email-based attacks, and the people getting hit the most with this sort of stuff might not be the ones you expect. Ryan joins us later on for that conversation in this week's sponsor interview with thanks to Proofpoint. All of that is coming up later, but first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, big news this week, the corporate pigopolists at Microsoft has seized control of the people's repository.
Yes, indeed. They bought GitHub for $7.5 billion, which is what, like 0.3 of a LinkedIn or three Mojangs, I guess, is the metric to use these days. So yeah, they bought GitHub, Q wailing and so much gnashing of teeth from all of the poor open source hippies whose hopes and dreams have been forever crushed, at least the ones that are still living in the 90s anyway. For other people, it does seem that perhaps open source thinking has won the day, and that's what it looks like being bought out by Microsoft. Now, I guess, from a security point of view, there are a bunch of interesting angles. One of the ones that's been talked up, of course, is, you know, what Microsoft's approach is going to be on hosting, you know, some of the edgier content. I know HT Moore posted a tweet saying, hey, thanks, Microsoft, for hosting the Metasploit source repository. That's pretty nice of them. You know, a funny turn of affairs for those of you who know the history, you know, of the relationship between Microsoft and the Metasploit project over the years. So that's kind of a funny thing. But yeah, whether Microsoft are going to, you know, start to, you know, have to put the corporate foot down on some of the more, you know, contentious content that shows up on GitHub, I guess, is one angle. You know, there's obviously supply chain concerns that people have, although, you know, whether or not GitHub running out of money and, you know, selling out to some low rent operation was a better option than it being hosted and, you know, eventually hosted and run by Microsoft, you know, I don't know whether that's a that's probably an improvement, frankly. But yeah, it's certainly been the talk of the town around the internet. Lots of people fleeing, perhaps to GitLab, which is funny because GitLab's hosted in Azure. So, you know, I don't know what how that's going to work out for people.
GitHub Pages is another angle to this. Whether or not Microsoft will perhaps remove access to certain pages for certain regions like China, because, you know, a lot of stuff is hosted on GitHub Pages. And will they start removing exploits and certain classes of attack tools and, you know, some of the, as you say, some of the shadier, like maybe gray area stuff? And that is a legit question. But, you know, either way, I don't think it's going to be the end of the world, is it? I mean, those projects will likely just pop up somewhere else.
Yeah, but I think, you know, for small stuff, there's always going to be a place to host, right? That GitHub doesn't have to be, is not the only option. You know, it's just whether or not Microsoft manages to really balls it up in a big way, even, you know, given its importance, GitHub's importance in the supply chain of all the kind of, you know, agile, you know, continuous integration life that everyone is rolling towards, like whether or not they will be good stewards of that, I guess we'll have to wait and see. I mean, you know, they could do a Nokia to it, right? Or they could do a Skype to it and kind of make a mess of it, or, you know, maybe
they're going to turn GitHub
alone
into an Electron app. I think GitHub already does have an Electron app, though, so probably. I shouldn't even joke about that.
I don't know. But yeah, I mean, we have to give Microsoft a chance. They have, to their credit, at least put someone relatively sensible in charge in the form of Nat Friedman, who, you know, is a longtime open source guy and, you know, worked on the early GNOME project and, you know, isn't an idiot. And Microsoft, I think, you know, these days does kind of understand that developers and the feelings amongst developers are an important part of, you know, what they have to offer.
Because
right?
It's how they've maintained their position in the market is by offering really good developer tools so that people want to keep building stuff for their platform.
Well, and now that they're no longer the dominant platform in the way that they were 10 years ago, 15 years ago, you know, they have to. And I think that's, you know, I don't know. I'm not crying about this whole thing, unlike some people.
You would have 10 years ago, though. That's what's really funny.
I absolutely would have 10 years ago. 10 years ago, me would have totally been all boohoo.
Yes.
QQ.
Oh, and look, switching to another company now, Apple has had its annual cult meeting in the United States. And, you know, they're unveiling a whole host of new features, including, I think, multi-party, like, encrypted conversations and, like, some pretty cool stuff on the encryption side. Also, a new mode has found its way into a beta for the for iOS, which is that USB restricted mode that we spoke about on a couple of times on the show, which would basically lock the device from being able to receive any sort of data over USB, you know, after a week of no passcode entry. Now that's been dropped to 1 hour, so it looks like Apple is likely going to pull the trigger on that, and that's really going to piss off the FBI and will ramp up this crypto war stuff.
Yeah, it absolutely is going to. And I think, you know, it's interesting that, because when we talked about this previously, you know, the week number, you know, seemed an interesting compromise. And it does seem like, you know, perhaps after considering that and looking at some of the reactions that we saw from, you know, some of the vendors that sell stuff, Cellebrite and Grayshift, that, you know, a week was perhaps too much generous. And yeah, moving towards an hour definitely changes the calculus a bit. You know, that's not necessarily going to be enough time to get it back to the police officer's station and plug it into, you know, whatever device you've got. So yeah, that it'll be interesting to see whether it does end up hitting the release version.
Yeah.
But certainly, you know, it's going that way. And yeah, the reactions are going to be interesting. As you said, I think it is going to be, you know, the next big move in this ongoing crypto war. And, you know, it's kind of funny because we've talked on the show about, you know, how you and I have kind of changed our positions, or maybe I've changed my position and you've kind of stayed the same about, you know, the extent to which there is a need for some, you know, lawful access to this. And of course, as soon as I read the story about this, I thought, oh, great, haha, you know, crypto, yay, you know, us cypherpunks take this round. And then, you know, I had to stop thinking, but actually, you know, we're not saying that anymore, are we? We're meant to be more reasonable and considered about the big picture. And I'm not sure where this is going to head yet. So,
No, but I mean, it is a poke in the eye to law enforcement. And that is, you know, it's they've decided they're not going to allow any sort of status quo by the looks of things. And that is going to force the hand of various governments. Maybe they've done the calculation and they think governments are weak on this. I don't know. Maybe they saw the reaction to Ray Ozzie's suggestion of key escrow and thought, okay, we're safe. This isn't going to be sort of forced upon us, because the consensus seems to be in that that's a bad way to go. Yeah, it's an interesting development for sure. And it's going to have, there are going to be consequences that flow from this. Microsoft, meanwhile, has also added a security feature to their OpenVPN fork, adding a, you know, quantum resistant crypto algorithm into OpenVPN. This is interesting.
Yeah, this is Microsoft's crypto and research security group. It's been working on post-quantum crypto options for VPNs. And, it, you know, it's very much an experimental project to look at how you could use some of the available primitives that are theorized to be, you know, resistant to quantum cryptanalysis. We don't really know yet, because we don't have a good quantum computer to do quantum cryptanalysis yet, but in theory it might. Anyway, Microsoft's actually implemented some of these things into a fork of OpenVPN for research. If you want to play with it, if you're a uni student, you know, tinkering with the stuff, it's certainly worth having a hoon. It's obviously not a production ready technology, so don't expect to deploy it, but yeah, if you're interested in this kind of thing, then definitely have a look.
Well, it's good to see everyone getting ready, let's put it that way. The website MyHeritage, which is a DNA testing site, they lost 92 million accounts. Are these just login pairs, or does that also include like people's DNA info?
Well, if you believe the headlines, yes. If you read the actual words of the article, no. It's something like 90 million accounts, of which I think I read some numbers that were like 5 million had some actual DNA data registered with the service, and it wasn't on the box that got owned.
So you could then take the creds, maybe log into the account and download the data that way, if you crack the hash on the password.
So yeah, you'd have to get the hashes, crack them. Company says they're salted, but won't say exactly what sort of hash. I haven't seen the actual hashes, so we don't know. Anyway, crack them, log in. Apparently, it will also email you when you do extract the data, so people might get some warning that they've had their DNA stolen, which, like, if that's not a terrible, you know.
Are they going to offer you free DNA monitoring for the next, you
know? Look, they take DNA very seriously, and, you know.
Da-dunks.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously, if you are collecting DNA sequencing data, like maybe you want to, I don't know, get anything tested, have some multi-factor auth through something at all. But yeah, it's not a good look. But I don't think any of the vendors that do this kind of thing have multi-factor auth. So, you know, they're all as bad as each other.
Ah, they're not the only ones having a bad week, though. Ticketfly, which I presume is a ticketing company, they got defaced and all of their stuff got owned, which is, you know, unfortunate.
Yeah, they're a ticketing company owned by Eventbrite. I don't know how widespread they are in the US, but anyway, they got owned, defaced in a classic style, I must admit.
Yeah, Guy Fawkes masks and everything. It was probably GRU.
Yeah, or, you know, Lord of Iran hacker or something.
Yeah,
But no, someone owned them, defaced the webpage. They took all their stuff down defensively, either that or all got RM'd, I don't really know. But yeah, it was kind of nice to see a classic defacement in a way. Haven't seen one of them in a long time.
There you go. SS7, back in the news. The US Department of Homeland Security has actually sounded the alarm, saying that, those malicious hackers are up to it again and apparently doing bad things to the SS7s.
Yeah, there isn't any specifics as usual. And of course, it's the same set of techniques that people have been using, you know, since the 90s against SS7. But yeah, seeing it actually being talked about, I know Senator Wyden has been kind of winding up the FCC about it again, you know, with people tracking mobile and using it for jacking SMS and that kind of thing for SS7, you know, roaming and routing and that kind of thing. But yeah, it's without any specifics about, you know, how widespread it is, what the groups are using, what they're doing, how they're using it. We don't really know anything more than we have, you know, for the last 20 years. So
no. I mean, yeah. It's amazing to me that how little I actually use a telephone. And I'd suspect most people listening to this show would have the same experience as me. Like when I went to Brazil year before last, I was over there for 4 months. And, I didn't roam my phone number over there. I just got a local SIM and used data. And I barely even noticed. So I think really, you know, over-the-top applications is what's going to fix this. And then SS7, apart from the tracking aspect, it sort of becomes a bit redundant, this idea that it's this horribly vulnerable thing, you know?
Yeah, it certainly has become significantly less important. And I mean, SMS, I suppose, is one of the few big things that still runs, you know, it's still kind of interferable with. But yeah, I mean, this is, in the end, is why this has lasted so long, is because the phone system has kind of waned as over-the-top stuff has risen.
Yeah. Kaspersky's lawsuit, massive surprise. Breaking news, Kaspersky's lawsuit in the United States has been tossed. No, completely not surprising news.
Yeah, they were claiming, you know, that it was unconstitutional or something, and needless to say, arguments about constitutionality on this particular subject, you know, kind of national security from a bunch of Russians, did not fly particularly well, and they got well smacked down. And that, it's not quite the end of that. Kaspersky maintains their right to appeal, but yes, for now they got told to jam it.
Mm. Cyberscoop has a really interesting interview up with Kevin Mandia, actually, and because he said a few interesting things. I mean, he said in his experience of, you know, analyzing, malware and whatnot, and his company's experience analyzing malware, he says the Five Eyes stuff is the stuff that tends to play nice. It's usually got, it will automatically go dormant after a certain time. And you can just tell that there's been lawyers all over it, which is interesting. And then, the Chinese are actually pretty good in that sense as well. And then he said everyone else, it's just, you know, they just do whatever they can. He also had some very interesting comments about, and we spoke, of course, about Kaspersky Lab drawing attention to malware that was being used by the United States government against ISIS and Al-Qaeda operatives in, you know, internet cafes in the Middle East. And he had some very interesting comments about that whole disclosure thing as well. He said that they would often actually get in touch with Five Eyes agencies and say, look, we are about to actually burn this op of yours, just letting you know. So that's the way that they sort of navigated the complexities and nuances involved here, is they would quietly kick this stuff off their customer networks, but they would give Five Eyes a heads up.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting, for me, it was certainly the most interesting bit of this story. And, you know, you've got to kind of, I guess, respect in a way that he's just come out and said it and was kind of, you know, pretty straight up about the fact that you know, FireEye Mandy will just, you know, quietly remove friendly malware from systems they're investigating. And, you know, I think that's a, you know, it's nice to actually have that just said rather than us all being confused about whether or not, you know, corporate interests and national interests are different these days, when clearly they're not, as we're seeing with Kaspersky and as we're, you know, seeing with all the sort of the other, ties up between, you know, national interests and, you know, the cyber stuff. But it's nice he actually came out and said it. So that's good. And everyone knows where they stand when they hire, you know, FireEye Mandiant.
Yeah, and, they wrapped it up with a quote by John Hultquist, who's actually been on this program before. He said, look, I see counterterrorism stuff all the time. But there's a difference, you know, between stopping it and publishing it for everyone to see. So I think that seems to be where American vendors are landing, which is, you know, remove it, but maybe don't bring out a chorus line to attribute it and talk all about it, you know. So that's interesting because it's stuff that we've been talking about on this program for quite a while. A former Defense Intelligence Agency official in the United States in all sorts of trouble for selling secrets to China, including possibly information on U.S. Cyber Command. So, yeesh.
Yeah, this guy, Ron Rockwell Hansen, was arrested after being stung, actually, by American authorities. They set up a, you know, sort of cloak and dagger routine where they had a friend of his pose as having information to give him, you know, at the airport before he was about to fly to China. And then he said, oh, yeah, Chinese intelligence will really love this stuff. Thanks very much. And then they arrested him, which... yeah, probably not a master spy there.
Yeah, but exhibit way, exhibit A is pretty strong.
well, yeah. Unfortunately for him, though, or fortunately, depending on your point of view, he faces what life for this kind of espionage. So, yeah, maybe should have thought that one through, buddy, before taking, what, $800,000 from Chinese intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, from the looks of things, I mean, this story scans like he had money trouble, right? So, I don't know, gambler, whatever. Made some bad business decisions, who knows? But he was out. He was already out of the government employment, but he still had clearances because of his contracting work and whatnot. Now, a couple of times in the last few months, we've spoken about the possible impact of GDPR, the GDPR regulation on the Whois database. And ICANN, seeking some certainty, has now launched a lawsuit to try to get a ruling, really, on what they can do with Whois and GDPR and like what the rules are.
Yeah, this is from a European registrar, EPAG. They're a part of the Tucows group who've said that their contract with ICANN requires them to collect a bunch of data to put it in the Whois database, which is not compatible with the GDPR, and they're not going to collect it anymore. ICANN is now suing the registrar to say, hey, you signed a contract with us that says you have to collect it. And yeah, and the hope is, I guess, that this ends up resolving.
They'll get a ruling saying that ICANN wins, and then the reseller can then actually start, you know, keep feeding that information to Whois, right? I mean, it's an interesting way to get clarity on this.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess it pushes it back into the European legislature and into the justice, you know, area there, where the decision kind of needs to resolve the, you know, the relationship between these things, you know, needs to be made rather than, you know, I don't know that ICANN and one registrar can do it. Like, they need something that applies to everyone, you know, under that jurisdiction. So, yeah, I guess it's one way of solving the problem.
Yeah. North Koreans still going a little bit wild on the old internets, according to this story from Ars Technica.
Yep. Apparently they've ramped up the activity, you know, a bunch of new pieces of malware and other campaigns going around the place. Not particularly surprising. You know, you want to have good intel in the build-up to any, you know, kind of negotiations. And I guess, you know, the increased focus on talking, you know, is supported by information on both sides. So I'm sure everyone's hacking all the things.
Everyone's hacking all the things. Ah, two interesting sort of marketing announcements here, because really that's what they are. Although there's an element of public service in this one, Synac, which is, you know, a bug bounty provider that also, you know, I think they try to structure their tests more like professional pen tests, but still in a crowdsourced sense. I'm pretty sure that's their model, but they're offering free penetration testing for election systems ahead of the midterm elections in the United States, which is, you know, good initiative. Well done.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's, you know, on one hand, as a professional penetration tester, I guess I find it a little bit, you know, a bug bounty is not exactly the same as a pen test. And obviously, as you say, Synac's structure is a little different than a bug crowd or a hacker one, you know, where they do some more testing, more vetting of the people, and it is a little more structured. But yeah, it's, you know, on one hand, I'm like, but yeah, it is clearly a useful public service, and, you know, any testing at all is more than they're currently getting. And the fact that Synac is putting aside what, something like $500,000 worth of money to pay for this, you know, is clearly a public service. So, you know, it's marketing as well, but, you know, good for them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the real marketing announcement this week is CrowdStrike announcing a $1 million warranty for breaches that happen while you haven't installed. And I sort of wonder if it's like we saw this once before. It was Jeremiah Grossman was working there. I can't remember the name. SentinelOne, that's right. They announced that, you know, there was a $1 million guarantee, but it turned out it was like, you know, 10 grand per popped machine to a maximum of $1 million, which means you would have to get all sorts of owned to actually claim that cash. What's the go with this one, though?
So yeah, I mean, it's the same sort of thing, I guess, right? Up to $1 million worth of of kind of insurance, I guess, if you get your stuff owned. I also was super dubious as to, like, oh, come on, show me the fine print. I haven't read the fine print because it was very fine.
Yes, invisible print.
CEO George Kurtz did say that it is, quote, straightforward and transparent with no additional costs, no hidden caveats, and no unachievable requirements, end quote, which I'm assuming to mean is just don't read the small print. Trust us, it'll be fine. Don't worry. And yeah, to be honest, I didn't read the small print, so I don't know.
See, I reckon I should install CrowdStrike, right? License of one, then you can own me, and then we'll split the mill.
Oh, yeah, cha-ching, buddy. This is such a good plan. Oh, yeah, we're going to get so rich. So rich.
Hey, one of these IE0 days, I mean, it's since been patched, but it was when it was first released a 0 day. It was being used by some state-sponsored crew. It's found its way into an exploit kit, and you might think, oh, you know, what's the big deal? But I was looking at the details of this bug, and it is bad, man. I mean, it's we're talking like critical RCE on Windows everything, including Windows 10. And now, you know, I mean, it's actually breathed a little bit of life into the rig exploit kit. So that's one that you're going to have to be careful of.
Yeah, I think it was the North Koreans that were using this. And then it got snapped in the wild, patched, Metasploit modules written, and then dropped into a you know, exploit kit and things. But yeah, it's a straight up remote code exec in the Visual Basic scripting engine, the VBScript engine in IE, which, like, what year is it? Like, that stuff should have been dead in the 90s. But yeah, apparently still lurking in the depths of Internet Explorer and getting people owned.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely you want to apply that patch. As you say, it's critical across everything. So yeah, keep an eye on that one.
Yeah, well, especially now it's in an exploit kit that any Tom, Dick, and Harriet can now deploy against whoever. So that's interesting. Some more interesting browser security stuff. Apparently, Chrome and Firefox, there are some interesting side channel attacks against them that allow you to obtain certain types of information.
This is actually, it's really cool research. I mean, it's super impractical, but really cool. It's if you're in an iframe in a site and you want to understand what other stuff is in other iframes on the same site. So it's normally same origin policy. You wouldn't be able to interact with a DOM and read the contents directly. This is using like CSS image processing over the top of stuff that the browser has rendered that's outside of your same origin. And then you do timing on the filtering to say, like, basically measure how long it takes to render a particular filter that your iframe is applying over somebody else's iframe, and then from that recover the contents, like kind of pixel
by pixel.
That's
pretty cool. Yeah.
It's pretty cool. I mean, it's once again, it's like not practical, but pretty cool.
Some researchers from a company called Sync, S-Y-N-K, they've done some work looking at archivers and, you know, the old classic attack of arbitrary file writes and, you know, file overwrites and directory traversal into, you know, from user to root and whatever that archivers occasionally slip up and give you. They've had a bit of a comprehensive look at the state of that class of attacks in archiving software, and it ain't pretty.
Yeah, now this is obviously not a new or, you know, I guess exciting bug class. I mean, essentially this is taking any compression format and then sticking directory traversal in the file names inside the archive and then decompressing it and seeing what happens.
But I mean, that's good because you can do stuff like overwrite SSH keys and, like, you know, there's all sorts of stuff you can do with that. Yeah, so as much as it's old and boring, like, it gets you a long way.
Yeah, certainly from an impact point of view, being able to overwrite arbitrary files is pretty much going to lead to remote compromise in most situations, I imagine. This piece of research, I guess, is interesting because it's relatively comprehensive in that they've looked at a whole bunch of implementations across different archivers, different archive formats, and I guess, importantly, individual programming languages that don't provide good quality implementations of, say, unzip in the core library. So in Java, for example, there is basic zip primitive, but there isn't really a good way to understand, like, how is it safe to unpack an archive? And so they've been through all the different software ecosystems, like looking at Stack Exchange, looking at how developers find code to unzip stuff in different environments, different languages, and then said, okay, these ones are bad and these ones are okay, and then kind of matched it up with projects and software, common software libraries that people use. So that's a really useful piece of research, even if it isn't, you know, a new and exciting bug class.
Oh, and of course, we mentioned Microsoft's acquisition of GitHub, but there is actually a Git bug this week that looks pretty bad, actually. So yeah, Microsoft might have to get on that one.
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty neat bug. Essentially, it's a bug where it is not safe to clone a malicious repository, which it certainly owns a few people. You know, people expect to be able to do that without impunity. In this case, yeah, you kind of create a like crafted submodule that then when you clone it, gets code exec. So yeah, that's pretty neat. There's a new version of Git out. You know, I'm sure there'll be some interesting edge cases and workflows where that process is automated and it could lead to kind of straight up RCE. So yeah, if you use Git, you might want to make sure you're patched.
Now look, here's a great bit of news to end the week with. The NSA has actually like declassified and released a whole bunch of their like security posters from like internal, like the stuff you would see on the walls at NSA, 136 of them. And they're fantastic. They are
cool. There's certainly something for everybody in there. Like if you want the dankest, freshest memes, there's some of that. And if you want like awful corporate, you know, passive aggressive rubbish, there's some of that. Like yeah, it's a little bit for everything. It's certainly worth a lunchtime chortle to scroll through the list. You know, pick a couple that you'd like for your office. You know, print them out. Don't send the NSA any copyright money and good times.
Yeah, I'm getting a couple printed up actually for my for my new studio. There's the one with Rodin's Thinker. That's pretty cool. But there's even one with the Mona Lisa. It's like this is all 1950s to 1970s stuff. Very cool. I've dropped a link. Alec Muffet put a bunch of these posters like into one gallery. So I've dropped a link to that in this week's show notes so you can check that out. But Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much, my friend. We will not be chatting next week because I think you're off. You're going to be hacking the mainframes. You're hacking Gibson in Sydney.
Yeah, I'm off to hack the Gibson with Soldier of Fortran and Mr. Big Andy and Smalls. They're going to teach me a few things about the big iron, which, you know, I'm into heavy metal, all that kind of thing. And so, yes, you'll have pipes doing the news for you next week.
It's funny, actually, they approached me to help them promote that thing. And they're like, oh, we'll give you a little cut of ticket sales, you know, because I'm sure, you know, you'll be able to drum up some regos for us. And I think you were the only one. And I'm like, it's okay. Yeah, that doesn't count. That's fine. But that's going to be great. Mainframe hacking next week in Sydney. I'm not sure if they've got tickets left, but they might. So any listeners who want to check that one out, you can go and hack the Gibsons with Mr. Storm. But mate, yeah, great to talk to you. And yeah, chat to you again in 2 weeks.
Yeah, talk to you then, Pat.
That was Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Now, before we get going with this week's feature interview, I'd like to mention that Risky Business is having another pre-Black Hat party in Las Vegas this year. Last year was so much fun, we're doing it again. It's sponsored by Signal Sciences, Remediant and Bug Crowd, and we've looped in the Diana Initiative as a partner. And that means the first hour of the party will be exclusively for women who listen to Risky Business, and I'm hoping to invite some other women with established careers in InfoSec along to the party, and they can come along and mingle and share some career tips with some of the attendees and whatnot. If you're a woman in InfoSec with an established career and you'd like to come and be one of our featured party guests, email me, patrick@risky.biz, and we'll be shooting out a link to the event page soon. I'm not sure when that'll happen in the next couple of weeks. Okay, it's time for this week's feature interview now with Peter Wesley, an Australian who's wound up living in China, working as a security researcher and running the Shenzhen DEFCON group. He was in Australia last week to speak at the annual OSCERT conference on the Gold Coast, and his talk was essentially an overview of the Chinese hacker scene, how it evolved and what the state of the scene and industry is like over there. And it was a presentation that was full of very interesting info. In Peter's talk, I learned that the Snowden leaks turbocharged the Chinese security scene. I also learned that before that, the United States bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade in 1999 brought hackers together under the banner of nationalism, and that the same thing happened in 2001 when the US was forced to land a damaged SIGINT collection aircraft in China after it was involved in a fatal collision with a Chinese fighter pilot. I learned that Chinese pen testers get paid a fortune and demand within China is so extreme that it's unlikely we'll see Chinese testing companies offering services to the West anytime soon. I learned that the Chinese are building 4 or 5 cybersecurity universities. In other words, I learned about a hacker scene of a different type, one that has a nationalistic bent and operates inside a centrally planned economy where the government has the power to issue, shall we say, sharp guidance on what is acceptable behavior for hackers and what isn't. Peter and I sat down at OSCERT to talk through all of this stuff, and I started off by asking him if the 2013 Snowden disclosures really did have such a big impact in China. Here's what he said.
It certainly was a large factor in the growth that's happened there recently. I think at the same time, there's been a few other changes as well. there's been a lot more availability of kind of microfinance and VC available both in Beijing and Shanghai and some of these areas where a lot of the security activity is kicked off. Back in maybe 2011, when I first visited China, you'd hear people complain about not wanting to take risks. Therefore, there weren't many startups occurring. VCs would have to sit down with the parents of the kids they wanted to fund and persuade them that, no, your son doesn't need an apartment and a car and a girlfriend to have a future. What he needs to do is to spend a few years working in a startup. Now, that changed just in a couple of years. And the availability of funding, I think also the availability of other narratives about success. People started talking about Jack Ma, this guy who started Alibaba from a small kind of agricultural village near Hangzhou, now runs one of the biggest companies in China. And so kind of the prevalence of that, the fact people are talking about it, built a little bit of momentum in people who wanted to invest. And then that happening at the same time as this big demand and interest in computer security really just, it's like a perfect storm.
Well, and there were hackers already, right? I mean, there was already a hacking scene when all of this stuff kind of kicked off. And that evolution was, you know, scrappy people sort of congealing around each other and forming a bit of a sort of social structure and stuff, much like it happened everywhere else, right? I mean, that was what was surprising is the parallels between the evolution of, you know, the so-called, you know, scene in China and everywhere else. Yeah, it shouldn't be surprising, but I guess it kind of was.
I think that's true. I mean, there were obviously a lot of hacker activity around events like the Belgrade bombing around 1999 and then 2000, 2001 with the spy plane crash. So what we saw in the West was very, very heavy nationalization of kind of cyber attacks. But behind all that, there was really just a counterculture like there is in the West.
We should probably just step back and explain that a little bit more. So you're saying when the US sort of had to sort of crash land a spy plane, where was that again? Was that in
Hainan?
Yeah. So when they sort of had to crash land one of their spy planes there, what there was retaliation from Chinese hackers doing what defacements and things like that.
Oh yeah. So this is really kind of what's probably most memorable about the Hongker, the red visitor movement, where they really label themselves as patriotic hackers. And you can look it up. The Hongker Union is kind of one of the old kind of hacker collectives which existed, but they were really focused around patriotic action. But at the same time as that, there was a lot of kind of black hat activity, writing viruses, backdooring mobile phone operating systems, all the copycat industry around mobile phones, especially around Shenzhen. There was a whole malware industry feeding these mobile phone operating systems. And then after that, the popularity of jailbreaking in China focused around, again, the opportunity to have app stores where you could release backdoor software and monetize that through phantom calls and other sorts of activities.
So that sort of scene is what, you know, the illegitimate scene kind of gave birth to the legitimate scene, I think is where we've wound up with that.
Yeah, in part. So, I mean, look, I think if you look, 2010, this is where Wuyun, Black Cloud, started as really an online disclosure platform, and then it built into a sort of community site. And there was even a cafe in the kind of Beijing Arts District where it was called the Wuyun Cafe, all the guys would gather there. And gradually that really built up quite a strong community of people who had a positive view, kind of emerging from black to grey to white hat, kind of in an informal bug bounty system.
There were some arrests around that one. One of the examples you gave, the thing that really screwed them over in the end was they disclosed a bug in a really popular Chinese dating platform. And they did it in a way that meant that people started actually using that bug to like get free access to this dating platform. And there were arrests. Someone spent some time in prison for that, right? Like, so this was where the government had kind of let this scene flourish a little bit. And that was when they started saying, no, okay, too far.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much what happened. It kind of got a little out of control. In China, if you are suspected of a criminal activity, you will be detained whilst the police investigate it. What happens over the detention period is it can last up to 7 months, and there's regular reviews, and the police do have to present evidence before a judge of there needing to be... there was still cause to investigate. And so this guy from Wuyun was released after 4 months detention, apparently without charge. And so,
but the message was sent, right? Which is stop dropping 0 day, in popular websites. That's not on. Yeah.
Potentially. Well, but at the same time, what's occurred is you've got really good bug bounty programs emerging in China. Qihu 360 has Butian, Repair the Sky. It's kind of an old Chinese metaphor, which is a really good platform. Baidu has a platform. And so that's really removed a lot of the need. Well, it's created a financial incentive for people to disclose bugs in a more engaged, responsible manner. But, you know, I guess there's a... It's just the evolution of the industry there made Wuyun a little bit irrelevant. But certainly the site is shut down. It's been no activity for 2 years. No one expects it to come back because people have moved on to safer methods.
One of the questions that you got after your talk I thought was an interesting one, which is, you know, can we expect to see Chinese pen testers offering services in a sort of outsourced capacity to, you know, Western countries? Because, you know, usually you'd expect there would be a cost advantage in hiring Chinese people because you would think it would be cheaper. Your answer I found very surprising, which is that, you know, right now it's just great to be a skilled pen tester in China because the demand is just off the hook. And those people are making insane money already. So the chances that we're going to see, you know, I think what you said is it would cost you more to hire a Chinese pen tester to test something in the West than it would to hire a Western pen tester. It really, I mean, the demand is really that great?
Yeah, well, I mean, before I started at Huawei, I was looking at building a business on offering these people some opportunities. And at an early point, it perhaps could have worked. But then the rates started to go up so quickly once you looked at the costs of translating reports and kind of all the QA issues there, it essentially became kind of non-viable. But that's a good thing for all my Chinese friends because it means that actually, yeah, there's some great opportunities at home. The market's there, that people understand the risk there. They've got Edward Snowden to thank for that. I don't think it would nearly have as much growth and success if it hadn't been for that kind of wake-up call.
Another thing that you just pointed out there is this language gap, right? And it was the reasons behind the language gap that I found quite interesting. In China, you were explaining, if you move into the sort of science and tech stream early on in your education, you don't learn languages. And people who wind up going through the science and tech stream wind up in quite privileged positions. They're getting paid very well. They have a lot of freedom inside organizations that otherwise are quite rigid. So they really don't have any motivation to learn English. Thus, we have this quite skilled scene emerging in China where the bulk of the people participating in that community don't speak English and have no motivation to speak English. It's an interesting situation, isn't it?
Yeah, look, maybe I overstated a little bit because I do think, I mean...
Some people are going to want to, you know, learn other languages because that's a cool thing to do, but I think what you were saying really is the incentive isn't quite there.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. There's not a strong incentive for them to develop those skills. The Gaokao, which is the entrance exam for university, is divided into two areas, humanities and tech and science. And so the people who move into tech and science really aren't required to have very high level of language skill. Now, everybody actually kind of the younger generation in China has quite good English skills. They will understand. I can communicate quite effectively in English, providing I speak slowly and leave a lot of pause for people to kind of understand. But inevitably, I would end up speaking to some of the really technical guys in written Chinese, kind of in a messaging service, because that was a way to actually get the meaning conveyed correctly.
I guess the reason I find this interesting is because we're seeing Chinese research teams come and just dominate competitions, you know, and do some really amazing hacking. But at the same time, we're not going to see the Chinese industry sort of move outside those borders because A, there's so much opportunity domestically, and B, the language skills aren't there and they don't really have a motivation to change that.
Yeah, that's certainly a big part of it. It's a big enough market there. I mean, this, you see this with the Chinese internet as well. It's very hard for Chinese internet companies to move outside of China, just as it's hard for Western internet companies to establish a market in there. Even despite the Great Firewall, there's still just this uniqueness of the market as well as the language issues.
Now, you know, we just referred to these competitions like Pwn to Own and whatever, and there's been a bunch of headlines lately about how the Chinese government has sort of banned people from participating in competitions like Pwn to Own. Is that accurate? Or because I think what you were saying in your talk yesterday is there was pushback from the government in one instance, and since then people have kind of self-regulated so as not to piss off the government again. Can you actually give us some history of that incident from your view, being someone who was there, and what happened?
Well, it seemed to, even prior to the incident which seemed to have kicked it off, there was some talk from Chihu 360's co-founder that was kind of a zero-day nationalism, that why are we disclosing these bugs in competitions? We should be keeping them in the country, because once you disclose them, they're gone forever. So shortly after that, Tencent's Keen team used a baseband vulnerability in a Huawei phone to win one of the categories at mobile phone to own in Tokyo. So, you know, the Huawei phones are very popular with all sorts of people in positions of authority in China. And it seems that they weren't able to get a reliable answer about if this was going to be disclosed to the vendor and fixed in an appropriate time frame. Now, my understanding is it was disclosed and fixed, but there was no guarantee. And I think the fact that this was a Japanese competition underlined some of the kind of nationalism.
And sponsored by Trend Micro, which is a Japanese company, right? So I guess what you're saying is, like, it reached the wrong person's desk and they had a WTF moment. And what was the crackdown? What did that look like? Did the government just instruct them, stop doing this?
Yeah. They certainly, my understanding is Tencent was told that they shouldn't be attending these foreign competitions, and that most other teams have self-regulated. Although there's some mixed messages there. Some teams claim they were told, other parts of the team claim they're self-regulating, but that's how things work in China.
You get the vibe. It's not so much a regulatory edict, it's the vibe.
Yeah, I mean, and that's China. China is fluid, it's chaotic. But I think, you know, the effect certainly should only be felt in, well, the instructions were really just about competitions overseas, and there are some local phone-to-own competitions emerging in China. It remains to be seen what happens, I guess, with the CFPs for DEFCON and Black Hat, if there's been any chilling effect kind of in the security research presentation. So that'll be interesting to watch.
The good news is, like, you know, Chinese conferences might wind up being just amazing if they're, you know, if they're locked out of participating in overseas events. They're going to roll their own, and we're all going to go to them because they'll be great.
Yeah, and also, of course, you have DEFCON having their first overseas conference anywhere, is in Beijing, China, just last month. I'm not sure if that's related to this kind of growing nationalism around the cybers or whether it's just a happy coincidence, but it certainly is a good opportunity for Chinese hackers to feel part of a global community there.
So, I mean, you know, there would be some people listening who are, you know, just naturally quite sort of suspicious of China and everyone involved in the scene. What would you say to people who are just sort of suspicious of all Chinese hackers?
Well, there's as much variety in motivation and occupation in China as there is in the West. Some people work for the government. Some people do it out of interest. Some people have nationalistic tendencies, even if they're just hackers who are interested in finding vulnerabilities. So I think we should be wary of China's capability. Part of what I talked about yesterday was the leverage that China has through its education system to produce large teams at scale.
Now this was interesting, right? Because they've established like four or five like cyber universities to try to skill up. And you made this great point, which is the reason China has lots of fast rail is because they built a bunch of fast rail universities a generation ago. So this tends to be their approach, and it's the advantage of a centrally planned economy, is that you can do those sorts of things. How is that taking form at the moment? Do you think this is going to be a successful way to, you know, to actually bake cybersecurity into a centrally planned economy, or is it just, are they going to have the same problems that we've had in the West with education?
Well, I think the Chinese have a much more positive view of education. They really do believe you can teach anything.
Look, it's a cliche, but I'd imagine that the typical Chinese student is probably going to study a little harder than the typical Australian or American student. I mean, that is a cliche, but do you find that it holds?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are incredible pressures in China.
Yeah.
It's a constant refrain I hear from my younger Chinese friends. There are too many people in China. Now, there are a lot of people in China. I don't know how you judge if that's too many, but certainly that's something they've heard from their parents whilst they've been studying. There's a really urgent sense of competition, of wanting to seize the opportunity. I think that's partly...
But isn't that ironic that we're talking about a greater, you know, a larger degree of competition among young people in what is ostensibly a communist country compared to the West, where we're all sort of, you know, fat and decadent and kind of complacent? It is quite ironic, isn't it?
Oh, look, there are some cities in China where people go to live, and there are cities in China where people go to succeed. Shenzhen, Beijing, these capitals are places where people go to succeed. There is also a way of living in China which doesn't can involve stepping away from that competition. But certainly for the younger people, they do feel those pressures. And therefore, they work really hard. And they do suppress a lot of their individual desires and interests.
They make sacrifices.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is why, you know, you're going to wind up with four or five cybersecurity institutes full of the hungriest people in the world. Yeah. I mean hungry from a metaphorical sense, not from a literal sense, obviously.
Yeah, sure. Still, though, I think there's, as I was talking about in my talk, all of these teams which are doing so well in the competitions and doing well in vulnerability hunting in industry are doing that with a small number of really gifted individuals who are enabled and also enable that team. So it's a question I wonder about with putting more money into cyber education, how effective that's going to be at actually delivering kind of more than just an incremental engineering or a scale benefit there. And that's just a question generally about Chinese innovation.
Peter Wesley, that's a great place to leave it. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Peter Wesley there. Big thanks to him for that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now, and this week's show is brought to you by Proofpoint. They are one of the big providers of mail filtering, and as one of the big providers, they get to collect all sorts of juicy information on all sorts of different groups and attack trends. Our sponsor guest this week is Ryan Callumber, who heads strategy at Proofpoint. Ryan and I have spoken before a few times, and he makes a pretty compelling case that email security, while not considered one of the sexier topics in InfoSec, is pretty bloody important. He points out that only 0.5% of the targeted attacks that they observe even use a CVE. These days, most badness arrives via email, not via Metasploit modules. But beyond that, they've found that certain people within organizations just get attacked so much more than others, and this is information security teams really should be acting on. Ryan Callumber joined me to talk through this concept of VAPs, very attacked people, and here's what he had to say.
One of the things that we consistently see is that you have a set of people that are not necessarily VIPs that you'd think of as the most interesting people in your organization, but they're sort of VAPs, very attacked people, that are interesting to threat actors. And it's very often the result of them performing very interesting job functions that are not necessarily on the radar of a lot of SecOps people, not in the kind of classic threat model. And we've started to see more and more sophisticated actors really go after interesting titles within organizations that you might not have anticipated.
One really interesting example you gave me was the inbox of someone who does insurance for mega yachts, for super yachts, right? Like now that,
yeah.
And you think, what? That's a bit strange. But then you think about it for more than 2 seconds and you're like, that person's going to have an interesting inbox. And being able to send mail as that person is gonna get you some pretty interesting, I mean, it's interesting to criminals, it's interesting to APT groups, like super yacht people are interesting targets.
Oh, absolutely. And we've actually started to see people kind of move laterally through email. Once you've compromised somebody's inbox, you read their mail, you check out those sent items and figure out who they're trusted to effectively, who trusts them for as a correspondent. And you can see them, you know, basically proliferate both inside and to other third parties, basically using email as a vector.
So this targeting seems really like human driven based on who someone has contact with. I mean, it's difficult, isn't it, to then pull out meaningful statistics on the job titles. I mean, obviously you got your CEO, you've got your CISOs, your network managers. I mean, these are the types of people who tend to attract this sort of sophisticated malware. But yeah, it's not always obvious, is it, who is going to be the most targeted person in your organization?
Yeah, and it's actually the sort of thing that also points us to some fairly inevitable conclusions about what's happening in the landscape overall, right? The attackers are no longer kind of looking at infrastructure as the primary point of entry into an organization. I mean, that can be hard sometimes if you are good at patching and don't.
That can be hard, rarely, but yes, it can be.
It can be, yeah, especially for these sorts of organizations, right? But when it comes to current attacker behavior, it's much more about OSINT, right? I'm going to figure out exactly who has access to the thing I want, and then I'm going to target them directly. And I might not even actually use a vuln or an exploit to do so. I'm just going to socially engineer them into clicking on something. And if I can do that, I've done something easy rather than something hard, and I've gotten access in a fairly interesting way that gives me all kinds of options after the fact. But the other thing it really highlights to me is that right now security is one size fits all in most organizations. I'm behind the same network security technology, email security technology, endpoint technology as pretty much every other user in here. And we don't represent the same level of risk fundamentally to the organization. We have access to more interesting systems. And right now those gradations are simply not factored into what defenders are doing.
So the question becomes, what do you do about that?
It's a really good question. I think there are a lot of things that you can do on just purely the email vector, right? You can tighten down, you can do more sandboxing, you can let less in from the outside world that's untrusted in different ways. And all of that helps to some extent. You can really then take a set of other steps with highly targeted users that you might not do for everyone in your organization. Like,
and that's what I was going to ask. Do you offer like different like tiers for different users?
And we've absolutely seen people start to do that. Like when you realize that, say, 50 users are your most targeted out of a 10,000 person organization, all of a sudden doing things like isolating their browser traffic becomes feasible, whereas it might not be if you're trying to change the way everybody works. It also changes the conversation that security is having with their users. It's not, all right, I'm going to go make everybody's life a little bit more difficult because I want to reduce risk. It is, you are very interesting to a set of attackers that we know about. And here's the data that I can show you that underscores that. We're blocking it. You're not seeing all of these phishing attempts in your inbox, but let's do a little bit more to protect you and to protect, of course, the organization.
So I guess what you're suggesting is that when, you know, a customer of yours might be able to generate a report to show their most targeted users, and then you might want to adjust some controls accordingly.
I think so. And really, it's a complementary view to the classic views we've always had about vulnerability and risk. Right? When you ask somebody right now, what does your attack surface look like? It's going to be a Visio diagram looking thing, right? And maybe draw a couple of clouds off to the side that don't really fit well on a network diagram. But that's how we think about the world, right? We're IP address centric, and we have been for a really long time. But the attackers are
Visio,
not.
Visio war crimes.
Exactly. But the attackers are no longer IP address centric. They're effectively people centric. So if you don't have that view, the same view your red team probably takes of your own organization, you know, it's a really, really powerful, at least complement to the view that you already have once you start looking at your threat data through the lens of people and not through the lens of endpoints or IPs.
Do you actually export, I imagine you've got an API that people can integrate with their UEBA stuff. Because I think, you know, a lot of UEBA stuff, I'm guessing emails may be a bit of a blind spot. Because they're really looking at IP behavior and account behavior, not so much, you know, taking metrics on, you know, proportionality of threat or whatever via email through an API for their external provider. Like that's, you know, that might be a bit of an easily solvable blind spot. Is that something that, you know, customers can actually do?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I think they should be doing more often is taking note of blocked attacks, right? Just because the attack was blocked doesn't mean you can ignore it.
Yeah.
Now, this doesn't obviously fit into SOC run books, but I can learn a lot from that attack that was blocked. I can learn what the attacker thought was interesting about my organization.
Yeah.
And being able to factor that in is just something that we're not doing enough as defenders.
Someone tried to break into my house 10 times, but they have not been successful. So everything's fine.
Exactly.
Now, look, one thing I've always been curious about, right, is like this is something that I don't know. I don't even know if I've spoken about this on the show or just with friends. It's like if I'm a CISO, I'm probably going to set up a bunch of LinkedIn accounts, a bunch of LinkedIn accounts for people who look really interesting, you know, Windows domain admin, you know what I mean? Yep. Like HR director or payments processing. Just put that as a job title because a lot of people are doing, you know, search by organization. This is part of their OSINT workflow. And then they're using the naming convention of that company. They figure out what the naming convention is for mailboxes. Like, is it feasible to just set up like some honeypot mailboxes and have a corresponding LinkedIn account. So someone's doing their OSINT, they find this fictitious person, you've got a fictitious mailbox set up and you could just generate signatures based on that. Like, I spoke to someone about that idea and they kind of shot it down because you'd wind up, you know, you might wind up generating too many signatures basically. But I don't know. To me, that feels like an idea that could work.
No, it certainly could. You'd have to call that the reverse sock puppet, actually.
Sock puppet. I like it.
Well, so the sock puppets are like the fake social media accounts that, you know, try and get friendly with people serve them up a phishing link, right? I love just in general canary-like approaches to things. And we have absolutely a set of customers that do that. And it can be a really, really...
So this is something people do.
It's not unheard of. It's not common by any stretch of the imagination.
But how effective is it? I mean, have you actually looked at how well that works?
One of the things that's interesting is that the real accounts get a tremendous amount of bad stuff too. So very often you don't even necessarily have to do this in order to get hit by effectively the same attacks. But that said, we have seen where it's a really, really juicy profile for somebody that doesn't have a legitimate social media profile. Maybe a CFO who's banned from doing so by policy, that actually becomes a really, really interesting honeypot.
Well, and I was just thinking, right, like it's all about raising it's not just about, you know, attracting badness. It's about high quality signaling because you know that there's been some OSINT go into this. So, you know, you're dealing with a human attacker but then, you know, of course, this comes back to the whole problem with sort of profiling the human attackers and treating it like an intelligence operation is, okay, great. We know we're being targeted. What the hell do you do about it? Right. You know, you're back to square one to a degree.
Well, to a degree, but when it comes to mitigating the risk for an individual user, I can do a lot more things than if I had to do that same thing for every user in my organization.
Yeah.
I can really tighten down and frankly, endpoint controls. I can care more about the hygiene of that person's computing devices than everybody else. I can care more about their login behavior if I have any kind of a CASB solution. I can also care about things like their awareness training. Did they fail phishing simulation? Do I know whether they have access to other forms of sensitive data in different ways that I hadn't modeled for before? When I can shrink the problem to this set of highly targeted users and actually incorporate intel from just my general targeting, you know, that's when you can start to make progress. You know,
It might even make sense. Like, you know, we all know that user training is only so effective, but I feel like if you get your top 20 at-risk people, put them in a classroom and say, the reason you're here is because people are actively trying to do this to you, they might be a little bit more receptive to the training, right? So you're saying that, I guess, you know, it's really coming back to what you were saying at the beginning is you need to take this information and don't just say, yay, lots of blocked attacks. Take that information and use it to adjust your controls for those at-risk users.
Absolutely. And you think about, you know, Rich Mogul's points that he's made on the show a couple of times. You know, back office moves to SaaS, your data center moves to infrastructure as a service, endpoints largely get more secure, nobody's running AV on an iOS device. What are the attackers going to do? They're going to keep tricking us into doing their bidding in various different ways. That is going to affect the 99%, it's going to affect the 1%. And so what can be a useful way to understand not only the risk you're facing, but actually mitigate them in a way that is reasonably scalable, even for a large organization, it's to at least have this view of who are your riskiest people and what can you do differentially to protect them better. When you look at these heavily social engineered attacks, even for the most interesting users, even when there are things like rats and keyloggers, we see an actual CVE present less than 0.5% of the time. The actual number that we use internally, because we did this across the entire 2017 data set, it's got 2/3 of the Fortune 100 in the data set. 99.5% of all attacks that we saw on the email vector required human interaction to be successful. Meaning you had to give them your password, you had to send them data, you had to click on enable content in a Word document, open up a package or shell object. There's obviously millions of different permutations there, but these guys are just not using vulnerabilities anymore.
Yeah,
that makes it even more critical to understand the targeting.
Yeah, well, and how, I mean, it sounds like, you know, it's great that you can kind of measure the targeting if you're using a service like an external, mail filtering service. It's like those reports are kind of easy to generate. So that's a nice way to measure it because otherwise, I mean, you've shown me the type of job titles that these people just getting attacked and you're like, why? Yeah. There's nothing in that job title that would suggest that.
But I guess the advantage too, when they're not using CVEs, they're not using ODAs, is that, you know, probably the training route is going to get you quite a long way, right? And I can see the lecture hall now, right? Where there's people who've never met each other from this organization. Like, what do you do? I'm a plant supervisor. What do you do? I work in HR. What do you do? I'm on the payment processing team. Why are we all here? And then, you can do some, put the fear in them.
Exactly. And actually, I have to tell just one brief story about a campaign that really led us to think about things in this way, which was it was a Carbon Act or Cobalt Strike or FIN7, whatever you want to call them, campaign from last year. It wasn't super targeted in terms of the number of organizations it hit. It actually hit several hundred of our customers, but it targeted one title at every single one, which was financial filing analyst.
Wow.
And when you get hit by Carbon Act or Cobalt Strike, we're going to call you, right? So when we talked to most of the blue teams, they were just not aware of the fact that this person could have been important.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, what that person does is they have access to the non-public financial information.
Oh no, totally. Like as soon as you gave me the title, I'm like, I wouldn't mind access to their inbox. That, you know, it'd certainly help my share portfolio, my non-existent share portfolio.
Trading. Yeah. Exactly. But there was a huge amount of surprise. And we actually heard from a number of different, very sophisticated organizations that the attackers are starting to know their organization and how the business processes work better than the security teams are.
Yeah.
Because that's not the security team's job to always understand that. And so when you see targeting like that, you know, we're not necessarily always going to surface a campaign with that good of actor attribution, but it's worth paying attention. And you actually saw one last week with, you know, Fortune 50 Pharma. They had a guy with a QA title pop to the top of the most targeted list. And the QA title on LinkedIn wasn't actually very interesting. But then we talked to them and we asked, oh, what does he do? And that's the guy that submits the clinical trial data to the FDA.
Oh, man.
And they had no idea he was being targeted. And we had no idea who he was. But until you're putting those dots together, it's really, really difficult to really understand what the threat actors think is interesting about you beyond your domain admins and your payroll people.
Well, you know, I got to say too, like a few months ago, the SEC did put together its so-called, you know, cyber team. And I think a lot of that was about responding to dodgy ICOs because that was just a black hole in enforcement. Like it was a real, you know, real blind spot in enforcement. But I think they're looking at this stuff now and I can kind of understand why the formation of a special unit was required. I hope they're listening, by the way, because that's good info for them. Ryan Callenberg, thank you very much for joining us. That was really interesting stuff as always. And I'll look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Pleasure as always, Patrick.
That was Ryan Callenberg there. Big thanks to him for that. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.